seeking to join the BRICS group of nations, and China supports the bid. Ukrainian officials say that Russia has launched fresh missile strikes across Ukraine amid fierce fighting in the eastern Donbas region. And the death toll from the recent devastating earthquakes in Turkey and Syria approaches 42,000 as the hope for finding survivors is fading away. Thanks for joining us. Iran's president says Tehran and Beijing have agreed to enhance their bilateral cooperation in various fields. Ebrahim Raisi was speaking after concluding a three-day state visit to China.
The visit was made upon an official invitation from Chinese President Xi Jinping. We held several meetings with Xi and other Chinese officials and discussed various issues. The two sides expressed strong determination to enhance cooperation in different fields, including economy, trade, and technology. Many good decisions were taken.
Raisi underlined that the two countries discussed partnership in different regional and international bodies, including the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He said that China has also supported Tehran's bid to join BRICS, which is an acronym for an alliance of five leading emerging economies, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Iran's president was received by his Chinese counterpart on Tuesday. It was the first such trip by an Iranian president to China in two decades. Two sides ended up signing 20 cooperation agreements. In a joint statement released earlier, it was revealed that Xi Jinping has accepted Raisi's invitation to visit Iran. The two presidents also called for the lifting of U.S. sanctions on Iran and the implementation of the 2015 deal.
The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, has visited China for an official three-day state visit aimed at building up bilateral ties. The Iranian president arrived in Beijing earlier on Tuesday as the head of a high-ranking politico-economic delegation on an official invitation by his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Beijing. Speaking to reporters before leaving Tehran for Beijing, Raisi said that Iran and China have similar views on fighting unilateralism at the international level. During the trip, the two countries sought to operationalize the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement, which was finalized in March 2021 in a bid to strengthen their long-standing economic and political alliance. The $400 billion deal will pave the way for Iran's joining the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Xi and Raisi attended the signing of 20 cooperation agreements, adding to a 25-year partnership agreement to cooperate in developing oil, industry, and other fields. The two sides signed a number of bilateral cooperation documents in the fields of agriculture, trade, tourism, environmental protection, health, disaster relief, culture, and sports. The Chinese leader said Beijing opposes external forces interfering in Iran's internal affairs and undermining Iran's security and stability. And President Ebrahim Raisi said that Iran and China are friends in hard times, stressing that further strengthening of relations between the two countries will contribute to the security of the region and the world.
Iran and China have a long history of diplomatic and economic cooperation. China has now become Iran's largest trading partner, with figures showing volume of trade between the two rose by over 40% in the past Iranian calendar year. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. Iran is also eager to contribute to China's mega project, the Belt and Road Initiative.
The visit comes amid rapid geopolitical shifts in the wake of protracted Ukraine war and the end of the unipolar world order led by the U.S. and its Western allies. China is now among Iran's top trading partners. Since 2022, the 10-month figure of trade between the two nations stands at $25.3 billion. That figure has surpassed the volume of trade between Iran and its other neighboring countries, like the UAE, Turkey, and Iraq. Since March of last year, Iran imported $12.7 billion worth of goods from China, and its exports to Beijing stood at $12.8 billion. President Raisi took office back in 2021, and since then he has tried to readjust Iran's foreign policy with a focus on eastern countries, which has come to be known as the Look to the East policy. It aims to forge alliances with non-Western countries, especially China and Russia. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. The bloc is a counterweight against U.S.-led security and economic blocs and could significantly reduce the hegemony of the U.S. in Asia. SCO member countries account for more than 40% of the world's population and contribute about 30% of the global gross domestic product, GDP. It's widely believed that Iran's close partnerships with countries like China will significantly erode Western hegemony and pave the way for a new world order.
Political analyst Andrew Loing earlier talked about the significance of Iran's enhancing ties with China and consequently its joining of an organization like BRICS.
Since the Second World War, the whole world has been dominated by one single country, the United States. And this kind of position is changing quite rapidly. Organizations like the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, plus South Africa, has a great deal of connections with the rest of the world. Iran sits at a very important position in China's Belt and Road Initiative. China's Belt and Road Initiative, especially the economic belt, in other words, the economic connections over land, starting from the western part of China through Central Asia, and then extending all the way through the Middle East, including Iran and Turkey, and all the ways to central to Eastern Europe, the Central Europe, all the way to Duisburg, Germany. Of course, Iran is a major energy exporter. In gas and oil and also minerals. And these are very, very important because these are the very things China wants. And China's trade, likewise, with Russia, also very rich in resources. And China is the world's largest energy importer. And, of course, China exports its affordable products, which could improve the lives of the people all around.
The leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has just delivered an address on regional developments. A correspondent from Lebanon, Mariam Saleh, is standing by live to tell us what Hassan Nasrallah has said. Well, Mariam, this speech did cover some major issues, as it usually does. Give us some of the highlights where you saw to be important to be covered here.
Yes, of course. Well, it is a very significant speech, actually. Sayyid Nasrallah said it's been a while since he's spoken about things related to the direct confrontation with Israel, and today also going towards the confrontation with the United States itself. So basically, after so much condolences that he gave as a result of the martyred leaders, the families of the martyred leaders, and the victims of the last earthquake that we witnessed in Turkey and Syria, he went on to the political developments and mainly when he spoke about the fact that there is a significant transformation that is occurring within the Zionist entity, that what we're witnessing is unprecedented, and I believe that this is a very significant issue that he began with in order to tackle the other political issues, that the divisions that are within the what he called the temporary Zionist entity are unprecedented. The fact that you have hundreds of historians, you have former ministers, former heads of prime ministers as well, the current president of the Zionist entity, the Israeli entity, its regime itself, stressing that he fears that this entity will not last 80 years is very significant, because he basically analyzed the fact that it is coming towards a confrontation, an explosion. The president of the Zionist president also mentioned that it is a barrel of explosives that would go off at any moment, basically with two confrontations, whether internal within the Israelis themselves, that the Israelis would be into internal strife, or a big portion of them would be leaving, going back to the countries that they had come from as they founded this Zionist state. And on the other hand, they would also have a very massive confrontation with the Palestinians, who are gaining momentum when it comes to the resistance, to the support of the resistance, that despite the fact that we do have individual operations, resistance operations here and there, from youngsters, even adolescents, adolescents and even groups of people within the West Bank and Al-Quds specifically, there seems to be more support for this Palestinian resistance inside Palestine. But he also said that this foolish cabinet in Israel could lead to an explosion not only within its own entity and facing confrontations with the Palestinians, that this could even lead and spread to the entire region if they do violate the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. And this is reminiscent of a previous equation that Sayyid Nasrallah had also put on the table, that all the resistance fronts in the region would be ready to fight this entity and end it. And he actually reflected this when he spoke about the crises inside Lebanon, that the economic situation and this massive U.S. campaign against Lebanon, that the fact that the U.S. does not need a Caesar Act because it is already implementing it. It was enough for them to play with the price of the dollar, to remove the U.S. funds that are present in Lebanon in order to lead to this catastrophe, despite the fact that Lebanon does have corruption. We do have mismanagement. We have all these problems in Lebanon. However, the U.S. Plots against the country exacerbated the problem, and it has led to that crisis, which began in October 2019. And then finally, in this speech, I think it's very important that he warned the Americans, first of all, on procrastination and allowing Lebanon to extract its own resources, and second of all, on continuing these economic sanctions and all this pressure against Lebanon, not allowing Lebanon to get any electricity from Jordan or gas from Egypt. All of these issues and the continuous play out with when it comes to the central bank and the U.S. dollar, the price of the dollar, and how the Lebanese lira has lost 95% of its value. All of these, he believes, are part and parcel the responsibility of the United States meddling inside Lebanon, as he says, and that he told them that the resistance will not stand idly by. And this is on that note, basically, he concluded the speech, that it would not stand idly by, that if they do touch the hand that hurts, which is the people of Lebanon, that the resistance would retaliate against their foster child, as he called it, the Zionist entity. And it would be ready, of course, to retaliate in that area. And that would be something that would have an impact on the entire region itself. Basically, this is what he said. And he called on the Lebanese also to come together and meet in order to find and be able to elect a president that would be acceptable by most Lebanese factions.
Thank you very much for that. Maryam Saleh, correspondent there from Beirut. We appreciate that. Moving on, Russia has intensified its missile strikes on Ukraine as Kiev's Western allies vow to increase their military aid in defiance of Moscow's warnings. According to Ukrainian officials, Russian missiles hit the country's north and west, as well as two central regions. They said that Ukrainian air defenses in the south could intercept only 8-caliber missiles. Earlier, the NATO chief said the alliance's members are ramping up production of artillery munitions to bolster Ukraine's capabilities. That is why Moscow has repeatedly warned against Western arms supplies to Kiev, saying the move only prolongs the war. Russia launched a military campaign in Ukraine in February of last year and blamed it on NATO's eastward expansion. Moscow views the alliance's efforts to make Ukraine a member and to deploy missiles close to its borders as a direct threat to Russian security. The death toll from the devastating earthquakes that hit Turkey and Syria last week has risen to nearly 42,000. Turkish authorities say the number of fatalities climbed to over 36,100. They've also confirmed over 4,300 aftershocks following back-to-back earthquakes measuring 7.8 and 7.5 on the Richter scale. While the hope of finding survivors is fading away, a young woman has been pulled out alive from the rubble in Turkey's Kahramanmaras province 11 days after the quakes. Across the border in Syria, the death toll stands at 5,800. Quakes left millions in need of humanitarian aid in the two countries, with many having been left homeless. The quakes have taken a heavy toll on Turkey's economy and could reportedly lead to a loss of over 1% of the country's GDP this year. China slams as political manipulation the adoption of a resolution by U.S. Congress on the entry of a Chinese balloon into the U.S. airspace earlier this month.
The relevant resolution of the U.S. Congress is in disregard of the basic facts and is purely a political manipulation and a malicious act of hyping up. China is strongly dissatisfied with and firmly opposes this. We strongly urge the U.S. Congress to respect the facts, the guiding principle of international law, and basic norms governing international relations.
The Chinese official urged Washington to immediately stop the, quote, wrong practice of smearing and discrediting China. Wang Wenbin warned Washington against taking moves that could lead to the escalation of the situation. Tensions have been running high between Beijing and Washington after a Chinese airship entered U.S. airspace on February 4. The U.S. says the object was a spy balloon, but China says it was an unmanned civilian weather research airship. Beijing has censured Washington for downing the aircraft. The U.S. House of Representatives adopted a resolution on February 9, condemning China for the incident. The Senate also passed a pair of resolutions on Wednesday in that regard. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Iran's President Dr. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi seeks to operationalize a 25-year partnership agreement with China during his state visit to Beijing, the President's Deputy Chief of Staff for Political Affairs has said. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. China Daily wrote, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's China visit will highlight the two countries' strong mutual support, as well as Beijing's lasting commitment and actions to promoting peace and prosperity in the West Asia region as well as the world, officials and experts have said. They made the observation as Raisi arrived in Beijing for a state visit, his first trip to China since taking office in 2021. According to the Foreign Ministry, President Xi Jinping will hold talks with Raisi to jointly chart the course for and navigate the future development of bilateral relations, and the two leaders will have an in-depth exchange of views on regional and international issues of common concern. During his visit, the Iranian president will also meet with Premier Li Keqiang and Li Jiangshu, chairman of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress. China-Iran relations are based on a traditional friendship, and cementing and developing the ties is the joint strategic choice of both sides, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said recently. Beijing looks forward to working with Tehran to take the visit as an opportunity to strive for greater progress of the China-Iran Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, Wang said at a news conference in Beijing. The two nations will also seek to further play constructive roles in boosting unity and collaboration among West Asian countries and facilitating the region's security and stability, he added. China Daily added China's trade with Iran reached $12.32 billion in the first 9 months of last year, up 18% year-on-year, according to the General Administration of Customs. Mohammad Jamshidi, Deputy Director of Political Affairs at the Iranian president's office, said recently that the visit will be of economic, political, and strategic importance, Iran's Islamic Republic news agency reported. Raisi said in an article published recently of People's Daily that Iran will, as always, uphold policies to strengthen Iran-China bilateral ties, and this will not be affected by any changes in regional and international situation. China's economic growth and its outbound investment benefit the people of China and other countries, and we welcome initiatives proposed by China for promoting world peace, security, and development, he added. He said his country appreciates China's important role in the fight against COVID-19 and its support for Iran's efforts to become a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. President Raisi also envisioned greater bilateral cooperation under the plan for Iran-China Comprehensive Cooperation, a blueprint that the two countries signed in 2021. Li Shaoxian, director of Ningxia University China Arab Research Institute, said that China and Iran have a long history of friendly relations and are natural partners who support each other's core interests. China Daily also added Iran is an ideal country in the West Asia region for advancing the Belt and Road Initiative, and cooperation with China is key for Iran's economic development, he added. Observers noted that also high on the agenda for the Iranian president's visit is advancing negotiations on resuming compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, a landmark Iran nuclear deal enacted in 2016. Ma Xiaolin, a veteran researcher on West Asia region and Mediterranean studies at Zhejiang University, said that current prospects for Iran nuclear deal have been dampened by sanctions and verbal attacks by the United States. China Daily also wrote, China's consistent position on this issue is to reject attempts to politicize the deal and stay focused on negotiations. And the upcoming meeting between Xi and Raisi may bring more hope in terms of the resumption of negotiations on the deal, Ma told Chinese media ahead of the visit. Speaking to reporters, Wang Wenbin, the foreign ministry spokesperson, noted that the two countries have kept good communication and coordination over international and regional affairs. The two countries firmly safeguard the principle of non-interference in internal affairs and the common interest of developing countries, he added. Meanwhile, Mehr News Agency wrote in this regard, Dr. Raisi's visit to China to create leap in implementation of 25-year program as the title of the article, adding, President Raisi's visit to China at the head of high-ranking political and economic delegation is a very important development in bilateral relations between Iran and China. His visit will be carried out at the invitation of President of China, and important issues in various political, economic, commercial, and cultural fields is discussed. The visit of the president to China is of particular importance and indicates the existence of the political will among the leaders of the two countries to expand bilateral relations. And that is what Nasser Kanani, a spokesperson for Foreign Ministry, said in a weekly press conference recently. Referring to Iran-China 25-year comprehensive cooperation program, he added, the president's visit to China can create a suitable leap in the implementation of the plans and projects foreseen and included in this program. The program is a roadmap for cooperation between the two countries, and in this regard, several agreements have been prepared and are being finalized, and good documents will be signed between Iran and China within the framework of this trip. Mehr News Agency added the talks to salvage the JCPOA kicked off in the Austrian capital of Vienna in April 2021 with the intention of examining Washington's seriousness in rejoining the deal and removing anti-Iran sanctions. The negotiations have been at a standstill since August due to Washington's insistence on its hard-nosed position of not removing all the sanctions that were slapped on the Islamic Republic by the previous U.S. administration. Iran maintains it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Not inviting some countries to attend MSC, contrary to the principle of neutrality, speaking about Iran's reaction to not being invited to Munich Security Conference, the spokesperson said, the purpose of holding the Munich Security Conference is to help deepen security in regional and global spheres. Not inviting some countries is a selective action by political motives, which indicates the continuation of the wrong approach in relation to the development related to Iran and is contrary to the principle of neutrality, especially a country like Iran, which has an important, decisive, and undeniable role in the field of regional and international security. And this action means wrong calculation and continuation of wrong behaviors. Iran to respond to any action taken against its national security, answering a question about the military exercise of the Zionist regime and the United States, Kanani said, concerning the fact that the U.S. government is an ally and full supporter of the Zionist regime, the U.S. must be held accountable for any of its own and the regime's anti-security measures against Iran. Iran will respond to any action from any source against its national security.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. Whoever trusts in Allah only and administers the affairs based on His teachings will reach salvation both in this world and the hereafter. Allah is the only one that has been successful in all the affairs given to Him. This is why Allah refers the people in the Quran to the examples that had trust on Him to learn from their stories. The Godfary are those who made the covenant with Allah, and the unbelievers are those who had trust in entities other than Allah. Therefore, we must believe in Allah as the sole administrator of the affairs. We must also act upon His plans in our life so that we become God-wary. This means that in all aspects of our life, we only consider Allah and we only trust in His plans for our life. This strategy includes all dimensions of our life, from trivial points to the biggest ones. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Hidden Files.
Well, there is a distinct and qualitative difference between one breaking a law for one's own individual self-interest or violating it in the interests of a class or a people whose oppression is expressed either directly or indirectly through that particular law. Well, the former might be called a criminal, though in many instances he is a victim. But the latter, as a reformist or revolutionary, is interested in universal social change. Captured, he or she is a political prisoner. Well, this is an excerpt from writings by former political prisoner, black revolutionary activist and professor Dr. Angela Davis. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, you heard the definition of who is a political prisoner, according to this philosopher and activist. But the United States denies ever having any political prisoners. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who've been incarcerated in the U.S. over the decades who would say otherwise. Now, some of them have now died in prison, Some have been released and others are still incarcerated after being in prison for more than 4 decades. Well, many of these individuals were involved in revolutionary movements in the 1960s. At the time, most of the activists were teenagers or in their 20s. Imagine that. Now, they say that they were fighting against settler colonialism and oppression. Now, these individuals are elderly in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s. They have endured many decades in prison and have spent much of their time even in solitary confinement. Many of them are ill, and lawyers have petitioned for them to be released on the basis of compassion. However, the U.S. is still adamant about keeping them behind bars. Why?
Why American authorities felt that the Black Panthers were such a threat, and the reason why the U.S. destroyed this group and many other Black nationalist groups. What exactly were they demanding? They wanted freedom and the power to determine the destiny of Black and oppressed communities. The group believed that self-determination was key to ending their oppression, and they wanted to control the institutions in their communities. The Black Panthers were also seeking full employment for African Americans and other people of color. Due to the fact that Black communities had been exploited for hundreds of years, the group wanted an end to the theft by the capitalist system of Black people. They believed that the U.S. government was racist and prevented Black Americans from excelling. They demanded what was promised to them after slavery, and that was 40 acres of land and 2 mules, or the financial equivalent of it. The Black Panthers wanted decent housing for Black people and other minorities, housing which was fit to live in. And the group was also demanding that decent education be provided to Black Americans. They wanted what they called true history to be taught, which meant exposing the true nature of American imperialism, as well as teaching the reality of how Black Americans had been exploited and how they contributed to society. The Black Panthers were looking at many aspects of life, including health, and they wanted free health care for all Black and oppressed people. And they wanted preventive medicine to be practiced in oppressed communities. One of the first demands of the Black Panthers was an end to police brutality and the murder of Black people and other oppressed people inside the United States. The Black Panthers were very aware of the connection between their own oppression and the oppression of others. Thus, they wanted an end to all wars of aggression by the United States. They said the goal of these wars was to expand domination and the oppression of people around the world. The organizations wanted the freedom for all Black and oppressed people being held in all U.S. prisons. The Panthers felt that to begin with, their incarceration was due to the racist and oppressive system. And they also believed that any trials held for alleged crimes should be done so in front of a jury of peers. To sum it up, what the Black Panthers wanted for their people and others were land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and people's community control of modern technology. Had these demands been met, it would have ensured the liberation, independence, and advancement of the Black community in the United States. However, the imperialist capitalist system is not designed to liberate the oppressed, but to gain the ultimate benefit from their oppression.
Well, I would like to welcome a former U.S. political prisoner to Hidden Files, who was incarcerated for 49 years.
Jalil Montarem, former member of the Black Panthers Party, which he joined at 16, and founding member of the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. He was incarcerated at age 19, and he was freed at age 69. He spent almost 15 years in prison. He was released in October of 2020. Jalil Montarem established the first revolutionary newspaper from prison and continues to be active. He started From Inside Prison, a national campaign to recognize political prisoners.
He also started a UN petition against the U.S. having political prisoners.
Well, thank you for joining us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Montarim. How do you define a political prisoner?
How do we make these categories and define who they are as a result of their resistance of being dissenters to a system of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism? For us, our comrades are freedom fighters, right? They identify them as being terrorists. Why are they terrorists? Because they're opposing the ideals and the practices of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism. Right? They are trying to alleviate our oppression, right, by any means necessary, as El Hajj Malik Shabazz has instructed us, by any means necessary. And so therefore they criminalize us, right, and bring us to criminal court in order to charge us what they call criminal offenses, right, on their books, right, in order to protect their interests, protect the state, right? And so this is the reason why they don't want to identify us as political prisoners, because they criminalize our movement. They criminalize our people. They criminalize our movement, right? We've been engaging in war against black people since 1619, all right, if you really want to understand it, all right? When they had the black codes, they had Jim Crow, right? And they have mass incarceration, right? The school-to-prison pipeline, right? It's all criminalizing our lives, right? Our efforts to be actually totally free and emancipated, right, people. And so that is the reason why they criminalize us, don't want to give us recognition, right, and understanding that there is divisions in this country, right, as a result of white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, past and race divisions in this country, and that there are people grappling with this idea that at some point in time, we have to free ourselves from a system that has been oppressing us for the last 400 years.
Well, from your experience, do you think that political prisoners are treated differently than the average prisoner?
We find that political prisoners are naturally distinguished from the regular general prison population. And the reason why is because they're educated. They're educated and they understand the nature of their relationship to the state. And therefore, they try to remove those individuals from the population because they do not want the general population to be educated and understand what is the relationship to the state in regards to being an antagonistic relationship they have with the state, particularly based upon race and class. And so for me, naturally, being an organizer in prison, I have been organized outside prison, been organized inside prison, I often was targeted by prison officials to be put in solitary confinement and or have other types of harassments and being deprived of certain privileges that most prisoners get. They would deprive me of that. But the only thing that did make me stronger, made me fight harder, that's all.
Well, do you think that it has been proven to the international community that political prisoners exist in the U.S., though Washington denies it?
Excellent question. You are absolutely correct. The United States does not recognize the fact that they do have political prisoners. When I first put in my, I'll give you an example. When I first submitted my petition campaign to the United Nations, this was back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I had the opportunity to have a question asked of then UN ambassador to the United Nations by a guy named by the name of Andrew Young, the first black UN ambassador to the United Nations under the presidency of Jimmy Carter. And the question I had asked him by a journalist who was, when he was in Paris having a press conference, was, does political prisoners exist in the United States? And Andrew Young answered in the affirmative, positively, said perhaps thousands. You can Google New York Times, Andrew Young, political prisoners, and all those articles will come up. He was vilified in the press, vilified by the elite for having made that truthful statement, that perhaps thousands of political prisoners in the United States. And he was called to the carpet in the White House and told him to shut that down. Why do they do that? They do that because they don't want the world to know that there is dissent in the United States, right? They project themselves as being the moral humanitarian leader of the world, and that is a false. That's a falsehood, right? They are the greatest harbinger of and progeny of violence in the world. Not my words; those are the words of Dr. Martin Luther King prior to his being assassinated. He said the United States is the greatest progenitor of violence in the world, and we understand that. We know that.
Well, do you see a connection between the oppression of black Americans and the oppression of people worldwide?
One of the things I told the community, international community, that their freedom depends mostly on our freedom, right? Black people's freedom in the United States, right? I informed them specifically that when we are free, you will be free, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because we are in the bastion of white supremacy, you see? And so for us, if this empire, what we call the United States, which is in fact is an empire, right? Well, an octopus, right? You can see the tentacles all over the world, right? Well, they're sucking the blood and sucking the resources and sucking the labor from various, particularly mostly people of color countries around the world, all right? Now, those who engage in struggles for national liberation and independence and colonialism, neocolonialism, oftentimes they'll cut off the tentacles, right, of the octopus, right, to free themselves. But what happens? The tentacles grow back, right? And a period of time, the tentacles grow back, like what happened in Chile, in the Salvador Allende, right? Mm-hmm. As an example, when Pinochet took over after they freed themselves. And the same thing happened in various other parts of the world. Why is that? Because the head has not been dealt with. The head of the octopus, right? We are in the head of the octopus, okay? So therefore, as long as the head of the octopus maintains itself, right, then they're continue to create the conditions from which they can reassert themselves in those struggles, in those moves that were successful at some point in time. All right, so for us, it is imperative that the world know that the international community, progressive international community, understands that what they're dealing with around the world is white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, but we're in the bastion. We're in the heart of it, right? We're in the belly of the beast. And therefore, our struggle, ultimately, when we are successful, inshallah, when we are successful, the world will also be free.
Well, fortunately, you are no longer in prison, but can you tell us more about the overall conditions of these prisoners even as we speak?
Imam Jamil Al-Amin, right, who they know is innocent of the crime that he committed, but because of his history of resistance, they had to lock him in the prison system. Right? He's been in ever since, almost 22 years now, right? They know he's innocent. The guy who committed the crime for which he was convicted of confessed, all right? But they hold him in prison because of his politics or who he is as a political person. Another individual is Varon Zambaro. Right? This individual was part of Black Liberation Army, part of the movement back in the days. He did his time, was on his way out the front door, had gotten parole, had received parole, on his way out the front door, and Anthony Gonzalez, who was Attorney General of the United States at the time, called the prison and told them, don't release him. He's still in prison today, right, because of his politics, not because of anything else he's done on. He did his time. He guaranteed parole, right, and they won't let him go, won't release him. Another individual, of course, is Rochelle McGee. Rochelle McGee is the oldest political person that we have in the United States today, right? And he was involved in the 1970 insurrection, August 1910 insurrection with Jonathan Jackson, George's younger brother, at the Bruin County Courthouse, right? He was found not guilty of shooting and he was involved in that incident, not guilty by the court. The court would not accept that decision from the jury, would not accept it, right? He's still in prison today. Right? Mumia Abdul-Jamal. We know that he did not commit the crime for which he was committed. He's known around the world as a profound intellect, right, inside prison and outside of prison, right? They know he was innocent for what he did. They won't let him out of prison. We've had comrades who died in prison on their deathbed, and they won't release him for compassionate release, so they'll be dying at home, right, because of their politics. One particularly, Mutulu Shakur. Right, the stepfather of the great rapper Tupac Shakur. Right, he's terminally ill today. Right, he asked for compassionate release several times, and they denied him. Or probably martial law, he's going to die in prison. Okay, this is how they treat us, political prisoners and prisoners of war.
Oh, really appreciate you being with us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Jalil Motaki. Now, let's take a closer look at some of the political prisoners that were mentioned by our guests.
Assata Shakur. She is the step-aunt and godmother of late rapper Tupac Shakur and the sister of political prisoner Dr. Mutulu Shakur. She is 75 years old. Under U.S. President Obama's term, not only was she not pardoned, but the bail on her head increased from $1 million to $2 million. Dr. Mutulu Shakur. He is a doctor who specializes in acupuncture. He was very effective in helping people get off of drugs using his method. He was a black liberation activist. He's also the stepfather of rapper Tupac Shakur. He was charged and convicted for helping his sister Asada escape prison. He was eligible for parole in 2016, and despite being a model prisoner, his release has been denied. Currently, he's suffering from stage 3 bone marrow cancer, and he is 71 years old. There have been many requests made for him to be released on humanitarian reasons, but they all have been denied. Rochelle Sink McGee. Rochelle is the oldest political prisoner in the United States. He's 83 years old. He has only lived 16 years outside of prisons. The rest of his life he has spent behind bars. From the beginning, he was convicted of trumped-up charges based on racism. He says slavery 400 years ago and slavery today is the same, just with a new name. Momia Abu Jamal. Momia Abu Jamal is an internationally recognized journalist and black liberation activist. He was one of the founding members of the Philadelphia chapter of Black Panthers, and he has been known as the voice of the voiceless for his many years spent writing about issues relating to working class people of color, prisoners, and the underrepresented. He has written 8 books and countless articles and commentaries from a prison cell on death row in Pennsylvania. He has been incarcerated since 1981. He's 68 years old and suffering from various diseases. Imam Jamil al-Amin. Formerly known as H-Rap Brown, he served as Minister of Justice with the Black Panthers. He is a well-known Muslim leader now and has been in prison since 2000. He remains in jail despite another man admitting to killing the person al-Amin was accused of killing.
Over the years, there have been many political prisoners to die in prison or to be released and to die within days of their release in the United States. There are petitions and movements around the world asking for compassionate releases for these aging revolutionaries. Well, we will continue to follow it up right here and let you know about their latest situation. But for now, I'd like to leave you with this quote from journalist and political prisoner Momia Abu Jamal. Conventional wisdom would have one believe that it is insane to resist this, the mightiest of empires. But what history really shows is that today's empire is tomorrow's ashes, that nothing lasts forever, and that to not resist is to acquiesce in your own oppression. Well, the greatest form of sanity that anyone can exercise is to resist that force that is trying to repress, oppress, and fight down the human spirit. Until next time, we hope that we hear from you. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
President Ibrahim Raisi says that Tehran is seeking to join the BRICS group of nations and that China supports the bid. French workers once again stage protests and strikes against the government's pension reform plan.